Hello. This podcast is available unedited and ad-free at patreon.com/HamiltonMorris. Each month, I release 3 to 4 new podcasts, and it was Patreon exclusive until recently. Many people contacted me and said they wanted me to figure out a way to make it freely available, and so I decided to accept sponsorship from a few of my friends. One of them is David Rentlin, the founder of a company called Lucy Nicotine. They make nicotine gum, nicotine pouches, nicotine lozenges, some of which are made with synthetic nicotine, which I think is pretty cool. Now, if you don't already use nicotine, I recommend that you don't start. It's habit forming. But if you already do use nicotine products, and especially if you smoke tobacco cigarettes, I can say that this is a cleaner product. And it's also a product that I use personally. If you go to lucy.co and use the code Hamilton, you get 20% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by MindCure, a Canadian life sciences company producing synthetic ibogaine that is also engaged in psychedelic research with MDMA. They're doing some cool work and I'm on their board of advisors. Lastly, this podcast is brought to you by Top Tree Herbs, an herbal tea company founded by my friend and pharmacopoeia producer, Soren Shade. This is not a traditional sponsorship in that I'm not receiving any money from them, but Soren is actually a producer on this podcast. They grow their own kratom domestically in Appalachia in a greenhouse, which is very beautiful, and they source leaves internationally, do third-party testing. I've been to the lab where they do the testing. They test for heavy metals and other adulterants, and it's ethically sourced in tea bag form. You can find their teas at toptreeherbs.com. So this is a really extraordinary story that I recently came across. There is a now homeless drifter who in the 1990s worked as a graduate student in a prestigious lab at UCLA under an organometallic chemist named Craig Merlich. And while he was working at this lab, he did a lot of underground experimentation with the chemistry of psychedelics. I find this chemist, whose name is Mike Roberts, especially fascinating because he came from an extremely disadvantaged background. Nobody in his family was in any way associated with science or academia. His father didn't know how to read. He was impoverished. He was completely self-taught. And it wasn't until he was in his mid-30s that he even decided to go into academia. But because of this incredible brilliance that he had, he was able to teach himself all of the fundamentals, get into college, get into graduate school, and start doing this chemistry. Oh, and on top of that, he's disabled and is almost deaf. So this was a really amazing achievement, especially when you consider that many of the people in medicine and academia do come from somewhat privileged backgrounds. I think something like 1 in 5 medical students have a parent who is also a physician, and probably at least half of them have a parent who has an advanced degree of some kind. So to come from a place with no financial resources, no background, and rise to this height was an extremely impressive accomplishment. And when I hear this story, I think that there's a lot that can be learned from it. In my time in the world of psychedelics, I've met countless people, and sometimes I see people who are so enthusiastic that it worries me. I can tell that they are heading down a path that might be problematic. I remember at a conference in New York years ago, I was talking with Jason, and some neuroscience student came up to us and he said, "You've never met me before, but this isn't the last time you're going to see me, because I'm going to be a part of this world and I'm going to make a big contribution and you'll be seeing me around." And I thought, wow, how flamboyant and confident this person is. And he was talking about all the things that he was going to do and had so much energy and enthusiasm, but it was this sort of energy and enthusiasm that is worrisome and slightly manic. And so I wasn't so surprised that when I did eventually hear from him again, it was from prison. He had
gotten caught up in some kind of a ridiculous drug dealing scheme where he was ordering something like 5-MAPB from China. One of the orders contained a synthetic cannabinoid, and then people were hospitalized. And, you know, it's just a tragic thing. And last I heard, he was still in prison. So what I'm trying to say is that once you become involved in this world, it can be very seductive and amazing, and you can feel that you have privileged knowledge of something that other people don't understand. But it's good to temper that enthusiasm and remain as grounded as possible if you want to be a part of this for any period of time. You can get into trouble if you are not careful. I remember years ago when I was making the ketamine episode, I was interviewing somebody who is friends with John Lilly, and they were talking about how tragic the trajectory of John Lilly's life was, how terrible it was that he was once this great scientist with tremendous promise, someone who could have changed the world with his research, and he became a ketamine-addicted wingnut who died an addict, and the squandered potential in John Lilly. And I thought that was an interesting perspective because I've never really considered John Lilly a tragic figure. It's true, if the point of life is to accumulate the most degrees, publish in the highest impact journals with the most citations, get the most awards, make the most money, then yes, what happened to him is tragic. He did not become a serious scientist in the eyes of history. He became a wingnut. He became a wacko. But if you think about life in a more expansive way, he lived an extremely interesting life. He knew all sorts of strange people, drifters, movie stars. He did the research that he found interesting. He explored the realms of consciousness that he found fascinating. Is that the most serious thing that he could have done? No. Did it end up with him thinking that an extraterrestrial computer called the Earth Coincidence Control Office stole his penis? Yes, it did. Did it result in him getting breast implants and wearing a coonskin hat with a jumpsuit and a single glove? It resulted in that as well. But to call that tragic is small-minded, I think, because I think the point of life is to explore and to do what is interesting. And by all accounts, John Lilly was a fulfilled and happy person, someone who did not live anything approaching a conventional life. So this story, I think, has some similarities. On one hand, it is a cautionary tale. This is someone who was possibly weeks away from receiving a PhD that would have likely guaranteed him a future in academia, maybe a lifelong career as a professor or a researcher. Mike Roberts didn't want to tell me, at least in this conversation, exactly what happened that resulted in him being kicked out of UCLA. He told me privately, and it's a long story, but in essence, he was using psychedelics every single day for 1 year, and he started to lose track of reality. He didn't know when he was dreaming and when he was in waking life. While he thought he was dreaming, he exposed himself to somebody, and the results were catastrophic. Not only did he not get his PhD, which he was on the cusp of receiving, he never did chemistry again and has spent the rest of his life as a drifter. Now, he has an extremely good attitude about this, and he's actually happy. He doesn't see his own life as tragic, and if he doesn't see his life as tragic, who am I to say that it's tragic? He's happy, so that's all that matters. But if you are in this area and you want to stay, I encourage you to be as cautious as possible. And this work that he was doing was really fascinating. You know, this is chromium carbene chemistry that he was using to convert a number of substituted biphenyls into phenanthrene type tricyclic compounds. It's cool chemistry, and who knows where he would have gone with it if he'd stayed in academia, but he chose a different path, and I think that there's a lot to learn from the story, so I hope you all enjoy it.
Tell me about how you became interested in chemistry and how you got involved in this world.
Yeah, well, it's actually a long story. I was actually in my 30s, and I had done everything that I thought I could do. I'd been a mechanic, a machinist, a millwright, and I decided to go back to school and get a degree in heating and air conditioning, believe it or not. And I was in the library. I had to write a paper for English, and I decided to write it on the Salem witch trials. And I had done LSD and marijuana in high school and ever since. But I hadn't really thought about, you know, going into it as a career. But I remember reading in Medical Botany the story about topolamine and how it may have played a part in the hysteria in the Salem witch trials. And lysergic acid, which was probably responsible for the insanity that happened there, which is, you know, they make LSD from lysergic acid. So I became interested and started thinking about this, and I went and changed my major to chemistry. And I'm profoundly deaf. I was in my 30s, so I didn't have a lot of friends. I was still living with my parents, and I started living in the library and studying math, chemistry, and physics. Then I spent 3 years getting a two-year degree because I spent all my time really getting a thorough background in chemistry and physics, you know, quantum and all that. And then I decided to go to California because I was living in Charleston at the time, and I wanted to go to a university on the ocean. I applied to many of the California schools, was accepted to many of them. I was offered the Regents Fellowship to UC Irvine by Dr. Rick Zepis, who had a laser lab. And the main reason why he was interested in me was because I was from Greenville, South Carolina, which is the home of Charles Townsend. Charles Townsend won the Nobel Prize. He invented the major, which became the laser. So I spent my first year at UC Irvine studying lasers, working toward the creation of the first picosecond X-ray laser. And the classes in quantum math were just beyond my, I mean, I'm very good with math and I like it very much, but I just couldn't get into the quantum stuff. And at that point, I decided to change my major from physical organic chemistry to organic chemistry. And I spent a little time in Marjorie Cotterio's lab doing physical organic chemistry. And then she left to take a position at UC San Diego. And so I started looking around and I ended up at UCLA working for Dr. Mullet, working on chromium carbene chemistry. Chromium carbenes are organometallic compounds that are used in sophisticated organic synthesis of molecules such as pharmaceuticals. So that's how I got into organic synthesis. So it's like a long roundabout way. And then how I got into psychedelics is another.
You know, most people that are interested in chemistry are interested in it as a means to an end of some kind. They want to make medicines, or they want to make solar panels, or they want to understand some aspect of the physical world.
Right.
Why it's such a difficult discipline, and there's so much to learn that usually the only people that are able to get really deeply into it are people that have some kind of motivation or something that they're trying to achieve. So what was it that you were trying to do? Why were you drawn to this area?
Well, first of all, I never really thought that I had any sort of motivation. I love knowledge and I love books. I'm profoundly deaf, so I spent my life in books, and I found chemistry very interesting. I found calculus very interesting. I spent a year living, before I got into the university, I was living in the library studying old English, and then from there I discovered Isaac Newton, and I just loved his writing style, and the fact that he was a scientist, that sort of got into me, and I wanted to be a scientist. So I got such a good background in it. Well, I didn't really know where I wanted to go with it. I didn't like decide until I got into Mullet class and I was doing synthesis, and I'm like, you know, I'm really interested in medicine. You know, and in the back of my mind, I had an interest in understanding drugs, because in my generation, that was just a big thing. Everyone was, you know, doing drugs for recreation, even though it was illegal. I had a lot of experimentation, a lot of experience, but I didn't go into, you know, the abuse like so many people did. I was just interested in them, and I wanted to know more about them. I got to UCLA, and I made up my mind that, you know, I've done a lot of research by then, and I realized that, like 98% of the flora of Brazil has never even been analyzed, and there's a lot of good potential pharmaceutical medicine in the plants. So I made up my mind that that's what I wanted to do, because, first of all, I love the forest, and I'm not really into technology. You know, I feel like we're destroying the planet with technology, but I think there's a lot of good medicine to be discovered in the plant. And I got a lot of advice when I was at UCLA telling me, well, you don't want to go into that because there's no money in it. You can't patent plant drugs. And I'm like, well, I don't really care about the money. The money's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in finding the cure for something, you know, helping people. I never really felt that I had a need for anything. I was just going through life, enjoying it one day at a time, and it was just always a good adventure. And so it was whatever I wanted to do, and it's not like I needed to figure out how to make money, how to support myself. I just figured that would always, you know, something I could take for granted, as long as I didn't abuse myself and destroy myself. And I had a lot of enthusiasm just for life in general. So I became interested in the plant medicine. And of course, in the back of my mind, I was interested in understanding the so-called drugs of abuse, just because it's the sort of thing that people like to do. It's illegal. But anyway, I discovered that the psychedelics are non-toxic, non-addictive, and, you know, it was the sort of thing that people weren't driven to, but yet I saw that there's something potentially very beneficial, very valuable here. And so that's just kind of where I was beginning to think. I hadn't really chosen to go down that path, but then one of the jobs that I was given to do was to run the GCMS, the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, which is a big, very large, expensive piece of equipment that analyzes, you know, everything that's manufactured there, everything that's made. They have to get that information for the product, and there's only one in the department, and I ran that machine like half the time. So I was in the analytical lab, the big main analytical lab, and then one day they said, hey, Mike, how would you like to work with psychedelics? And I'm like, oh, well, yeah, of course. And it turns out that Terrence McKenna and some other crazy-looking hippies, as they called them, had delivered some blood samples that were taken from some natives in the jungle during an ayahuasca ceremony, with the idea of analyzing the DMT profile over time. So I was given that project and told to come up with a procedure. And so I started buying books and studying psychedelics. And I bought every book I could find, which is easy to do at UCLA. They have a nice bookstore anyway. And so I had my own library, everything I could find. And then, of course, I was living in the physical sciences library, which had all the publications. And the psychedelic publications were behind the counter. As far as I know, I was the only one asking for them. And so my interest just really began to focus in that direction. And I was getting a lot of help in that direction at first. I suggested that, you know, I could do a research proposal based on salvinorin, which is salvia. Salvinorin is a very interesting molecule in its own right, in that it's got seven carcinogens. LSD's only got one. It is as powerful as LSD, and it's found in nature.
And what year was this?
Well, I was thrown out in 95, so this was like 92, 93, 94.
Okay, wow. Okay, so this was right when people were starting to figure out that salvia was, because, you know, initially there was some skepticism about whether salvia was even active. So they had already discovered the structure of salvinorin at that point.
Yeah, it was just sort of beginning to be talked about. And I just found it a very interesting I did. Well, first of all, my friend, he was in charge of the botanical garden there, Gardens at UCLA, and I talked to him about it. And he said, well, we've already tried raising that plant at one time for somebody, and yeah, we could do it again. So I'm like, okay, let's raise the plant. Let's extract the salvinorin. Let's make some analogs. Let's make some molecules that are like it, from it, that sort of thing. And so this just opened the door to a lot of ideas. This is just one of the interests that I had. So eventually I contacted the Albert Hofmann Foundation. They sent someone out because they were right there in Santa Monica. They had just actually set up there. All the people that I could that were interested in psychedelics, I even spoke with Alexander Chogan. I spoke with Dennis McKenna about my ideas, and it just all come together. I said, let's establish the Center for Psychedelic Research, the CPR at UCLA. And, you know, some of my professors were nervous about the idea, but some of them thought, you know, it might be a good idea. It was much later, after I left the university, I found out, I can't remember his name now, but whoever it was that he considered the top authority for LSD, it was actually there at UCLA the whole time. I never heard of him, never interacted with him, but I just felt like, you know, that there was a lot of talk about what I was doing, and, you know, there was a lot of skepticism, and, you know, we just didn't know which way we were going to go. And so, but the thing is, when I started getting all this knowledge, then I decided, well, you know, I don't see anything wrong with making this stuff. So I began to, you know, I had the keys to the lab. I could come and go as I wanted, during nighttime. Sometimes, you know, I'd just take small steps little by little. But in the end, I ended up making, I don't know, 9 or 10 different psychedelic compounds. I had all the recipes. I had all the chemicals. It was just a matter of, you know, doing this on my own and not telling other people about it. So anyway, I had these things, and I was taking small doses, just enough to get a baseline. And I didn't do like most people and just say, like, wait until Saturday and take a big dose and have an earth-shattering experience. I was just looking for the possibility of these compounds being beneficial or taken in small doses. And so anyway, I ended up with, like I said, 7 or 8 different compounds, and taking the mild ones during the week while I was at work, and stronger ones on the weekend. So I'd get off work on Friday around 5 o'clock. I would dose and ride my bicycle 7 miles from campus up to the top of the mountain where I lived. And, you know, the adrenaline and the effort, I think, sort of helped to amplify the experience. Anyway, as it is, I had a lot of very interesting experiences.
So you mentioned that Terrence McKenna had sent blood samples taken from Amazonian shamans.
Yeah.
What were they hoping to find?
Well, I don't know exactly what they were looking for, other than, you know, another publication in which they basically described, I don't know. It's been so long ago, I don't know what other compounds besides DMT, but, you know, things that are in the blood that are involved, like, the decomposition products or whatever, other molecules that are associated with the experience, you know, find the molecules of interest and then do a profile, you know, a time study of the compounds in the bloodstream, you know, how they change. You know, the ayahuasca isn't just DMT, but it's the homiline or the capi, the monoamine oxidase inhibitors. So there's a lot of compounds of interest in the experience, and I think that's just basically what they wanted to do, is to get some sort of a profile that they could get a publication out of. You know, any kind of publication involving psychedelics would help to reopen the door that was closed. I think what happened, like in the early 60s, I did LSD for the first time in 1971 when I was 15. And of course, 2 years before that, in 1969, I kind of look back on it and see that, you know, it looked almost as if it was designed to have the Charles Manson things happen in order that they could use that in order to say, you know, this is bad stuff. Look what it's doing to people. We have to stop it completely. And I think it's, you know, the sort of thing that was amped up and hypersensitized, and all this bad news associated with it, you know, the reports of flashbacks and all this stuff. You know, the psychedelics are totally harmless. However, they got such a bad reputation from the press back in the 60s that they just put a moratorium out and said, no research, no nothing, it's illegal, boom, that's it. And so, and I'll tell you briefly, the idea that I just had, it's like, okay, you have a mirror, you look in your mirror. A mirror is a solid resonance, it's like a wall. And my experience with the psychedelics, let's just say, for example, just DMT, it has a specific frequency, it has a specific resonance. So it's sort of like a wall. When you wake up from a deep sleep and you have this resonance in your brain and this sensation of deep color blue, that's DMT. It's like a resonance. And we are just a jumble of resonances. And all of our ideas, our experience, you know, our mind is a waveform. If you were to do a Fourier transform on it and bring out all the frequencies that were simultaneously operating, it'd be a very complex picture. But when you come up against DMT, it's like a visual image coming up against a mirror. It's just a resonance that reflects back to you the other frequencies, the resonances that are there, because you come up against a single specific frequency. But yeah, so I don't see the drug as being an entity other than just a reflection. And so every experience is unique, and what it does, it reflects back to you parts of you that you are aware of but not aware of. Because now all of a sudden, it's like looking into a mirror. You might know something about yourself, but now you see it very clearly. You're just reflecting your image from a solid resonance. And so I've done, you know, many psychedelics many times. And like LSD, I used to take it every day. I'm talking about recently. When I go to California, it's very easy to get, and I would just take first thing in the morning and all day long. It'd just be that resonance that I feel, and it's a calm, peaceful resonance. I began to think of it as more like a cardiovascular regulator, which is a good thing, you know, because we have people that are very confused, and it's like their minds are all over the place, and they have no grasp on reality. They have no grasp on how to keep themselves stable. But then now you introduce something like LSD. Like I'm saying, I'm trying to find a potential use of these compounds rather than saying, you know, you take it once in a while and you have this meaningful experience. I'm trying to find that there's actually a solution to the problem of misery. And then people can take a dose daily. It would be much less harmful than taking Prozac or any of the other antidepressants, which are dangerous. And so anyway, I was a chemist studying all this stuff, and I realized that as a chemist, I was creating so much pollution, you know, to try to write another paper. Or I would, you know, I could go into pharmaceuticals with the hope of making a lot of money. At one point, they came to me and said, why don't you also get a degree in law, and then you can start out as a patent lawyer, and you can start out at $190,000 a year. And I'm like, but that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in medicine. I'm interested in finding solutions to problems. I'm not interested in making money for myself. I just always assumed that the money would be there, you know? So hope that gives you some idea.
No, it's all really interesting. And the work that you were doing with chromium carbenes, can you tell me a little bit about that? Because I think that sort of organometallic chemistry is something that a lot of people listening to this won't be familiar with. So okay. What was that lab, and how did you get involved with that, and what sort of work was going on there?
Well, okay. So I go to work for Craig Merlick, and he's interested in Fischer chromium carbenes. Carbenes, this is where you create compounds that are hydrocarbons, but they have a chromium attached to them. And the chromium creates a very active site that allows you to do very exotic chemistry that's impossible otherwise. And so when I went to work for Merlick, first thing he did was take me in the lab, and I see a 500 milliliter flask of bright orange swirling liquid, you know, ether. And I said, wow, that's a gorgeous color. He said, yeah, that's carbenes. He kind of explained them to me. And I asked him, I said, are they all that color? He said, no, some are red, some are yellow, some are orange. But I said, but no blue ones. He said, no, no blue ones. I said, well, I'm going to make the first blue one. You know, I was just joking. And then it turns out 2 or 3 years into the research, sure enough, and it's just a very interesting story in itself. the blue chromium carbine. It was just one thing that we were trying to do, and we had a lot of, we weren't trying to make blue carbines. The carbines that we were making for study to determine, okay, so we have a biphenyl system that cyclizes to generate a six-membered ring when the chromium on one phenyl group, it inserts a carbon, first of all, from the carbonyl, and then cyclizes so that you have a new six-membered ring between the two biphenyls. We put a lot of groups on the other molecule to determine whether it would cyclize ortho or para. We were looking for the ortho-para selectivity, you know, based on what groups we had on the second ring. And there was a dimethyl amino group that we wanted to put that one on there. And we did. We put the dimethyl amino group on there, but the reactivity was so different. Instead of turning yellow or orange, you know, when it was supposed to cyclize, it just turned black, totally black. And so we're like, okay, it's all garbage. And then at one point he said, you know, I want you to go back and see if you can fish something out of that, because I have an idea that something else has happened. And sure enough, I was able to fish out something. It was only like a 1% yield. But when I did the NMR, it verified his suspicion, which was that it did not cyclize to a six-membered ring. It cyclized to a five-membered ring, which was totally new chemistry. So the blue chromium carbene, that was the first one ever made, and the cyclization reaction, that was the first time that reaction ever happened. And so anyway, I got enough of the product that I was able to crystallize it. And I got the crystals, they looked like pieces of copper. They were so magnificent. And we got X-ray identification, so we got crystallization, X-ray crystallization spectroscopic data, so we know the exact structure of the molecule. You can take one of those little tiny crystals and drop it into a liter of ether, and it would just turn to the deepest, darkest blue color you can imagine. So anyway, that was something I was very excited about. That, you know, I was going to have this to my name. But that paper never got published because of the, you know, the trouble I got into with the psychedelics. So, you know, this would be very interesting in the production of complex molecules. And I had a molecule of interest, and that was hypericin, because I had discovered that, well, in my opinion, hypericin is the cure for HIV. That's another very interesting chapter in the book I want to write about what I discovered about HIV and experience that I had in terms of this natural product called hypericin, which comes from St. John's Wort. And if you look at the structure of hypericin, it's a very interesting structure, and it's a very challenging structure to try to make. You know, the holy grail of one of the holy grails of chemistry, I don't know if it still is, but back at that time in 94, was to be able to make morphine, synthesize it from scratch in the laboratory in less than 10 steps, because that's the only way it can be considered economically feasible. And nobody had done that yet. You know, of course, there's a lot of people still trying to do it. Well, it turns out that I was able to synthesize, you know, doing a retrosynthetic analysis. I was a very good synthetic chemist. Not as good as some, of course, but I really enjoyed it. I was married to chemistry. I had nothing else to take my focus away. And so it's just a very rich play field for me. And I loved coming up with new syntheses. And I came up with a synthesis for hypericin, which involved two steps, two procedures that had not yet been reported in the literature. And one was the chemistry that I was working on at UCLA, and another was a process that was being developed at Santa Barbara in Lipschitz's lab. And so these procedures had not been reported, and they were key steps in my proposed synthesis of hypericin. And so anyway, I wrote a proposal for the synthesis of hypericin and some analogs, and the proposal came in 27 pages. I was very proud of it. I got a lot of compliments on it. I sent it to the National Institutes of Health. They didn't even read it. They sent it right back to me. Said, we have a 7-page limit. So here I am trying to reduce it down from 27 pages to 7. And there's so much other stuff going on. Of course, that never happened. But however, if you're a chemist and you look at hypericin and also the mechanism of action by which hypericin takes out HIV is a very interesting mechanism. And it just surprises me that there's no interest in this type of thing in the profession, because you know, with HIV, the only thing that they're interested in is drug that they can make money off of. And Hypericin's a natural product, so can't make any money off of it. And, you know, that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, thinking, you know, all these people, they're making money off of medicine, and they're destroying the field because they're destroying anyone else from having any input. They dominate, and it's all about profit for them. So that's when I said, you know, I've had enough of this. And so that's why I just did what I wanted to do. And, you know, I knew they were going to throw me out eventually, and they did. So I thought I had a great career going, you know, because of that. But of course, I got sidetracked.
Right. And so, okay, so you're doing this organometallic chemistry. At what point did you decide that you were going to make a psychedelic?
Well, it's pretty early. I would say I think I spent about 4 years in the university. And the interesting thing is I started on April the 1st of 1 year, and 4 years later on April the 1st, I got thrown out. So I kind of wonder if the whole thing is just imagined. But I think it was about at the halfway point that, well, you know, I made some mescaline. That was the first one. And I was just interested to see what it was like, and I took a small dose, and I realized that it made me more articulate, it made me more outgoing. I'm profoundly deaf. I've always had a problem of being very shy, and it would make me, you know, suffer a little bit. But all of a sudden now, with this microdosing on the methylene, I realized that I was happy, I was outgoing, I was much more articulate, I didn't stutter when I wanted to say something. And so I got to thinking, you know, this is good for me. And you mean to tell me that they're going to stand between me and what's good for me? They're going to say that I can't make and take these compounds for some reason? No, I don't think so. I just leave them out of it and I do what I want to do. And so at that point, I just threw the door open to myself. This is the decision that I made. I said, you know what, we live in a time in which we don't even have a rite of initiation into manhood. This is mine. I'm going to initiate myself into manhood by doing something illegal. And that illegal thing that I did was trespass. I trespassed. They told me not to do this. I did it anyway. So anyway, at that point, I just felt very righteous about what I was doing. Had access to all the chemicals. I knew what I was doing. Nobody said anything. And, you know, people like me, they just sort of, well, you know, he's kind of strange, whatever, but they left me alone. And so we just didn't talk about it. And so I just did what I wanted to do. I made a lot of stuff. And like I said, I was microdosing every day. I was taking 2CB 3 times a day. It lasts 4 hours. It's a very mild psychedelic. And the primary effect that I got from it was one of lightness. I would put a little powder in my hand, lick it, and then 5 minutes later, I just felt like I lost our weight. I went from being material to being spiritual. And, you know, like I said, my ability to articulate myself, to feel good about myself, that just, you know, a lot of people have this problem because to take a psychedelic means to break the law, which means there's that element of shame. You know, you're doing something wrong, you have to deal with that. I didn't have to deal with that because I made up my mind that they were the ones that was wrong. It was perfectly okay for me to do this. So I started doing that, and it was Friday, May the 13th of 1993. I just remember it was May the 13th, and it was a Friday, and that was the day when I started. And I said, I'm going to take them every day for 1 year, every day. And there were 2 days during that one-year period when I said, I got up, and I said, you know what, I'm not going to take anything today. I'm going to go to work. And I'm going to see if I have a headache, if I come down, if I, you know, have any withdrawal effect. None. I just felt normal. I didn't feel that light elevation in happiness and, you know, everything else that I get from the psychedelics. I just felt normal. So there was no withdrawal effect there. That verified to me that it was not harmful what I was doing. I think the biggest part of the harm comes in, you know, with you thinking the resonances that you set up in your mind about, I'm doing something wrong. I don't want to get caught. See, I didn't allow all that into my mind. I just felt like what I was doing was good. They didn't have to know about it. If they knew about it, they didn't say anything or whatever. So, okay. So, anyway, this went on for about 8 months. And then at that point, that's when I discovered DMT, which is the most powerful. of them. And at that point, I had built up to it. You know, like taking 2CB during the week, DOM on the weekend, that sort of thing. DET, diethyltryptamine, oh wow, that's so profound. The peace and the resonance of peace that it brings, you know, used as a sacrament in some places in New York, it was actually legal. So anyway, I'm developing all these ideas and having all these experiences. But when I got to the DMT, that was so profound, it was a whole nother thing. And after about 2 months of DMT on a daily basis, and I began mixing it with other things. Now, this is something for any chemist out there who's making these things. I would like input from somebody else on this because I made a lot of stuff and I mixed a lot of stuff together after, you know, with this point of daily use for a long period of time. And I mixed DMT and DIPT, diisopropyltryptamine. And I had the most unbelievably mind-blowing experience every time I did it. To me, this was just like the greatest discovery in the history of medicine. But, you know, I'm wondering if it's just me personally or if this is actually something that it really is, you know, a valuable medicine. As a matter of fact, the mixture of DMT and DIPT, when I first took it, I was actually in the lab. I was just, you know, I went in the bathroom, I took it, and I come back, and I was sitting there waiting for it to come on, and I entered what I remember being the very fountainhead of religious dogma and magical symbolism. It's like I understood all religion, all magic, and it said, I am the elixir of life. And I had never even heard of that. And this is the other thing that's so interesting, because I was having all these psychedelic experiences, but they were not separate from my reality. They were part of it. So, for example, I would have so many coincidences. So the drug spoke to me. It says, I am the elixir of life. And then the next day or the next week or whatever, I begin reading about it. So I started taking an interest in alchemy. Alchemy was the study of his chemistry a long time ago. And the elixir of life was just another name for the Holy Grail or something like that, you know. You know, at this point, I have to wonder, where is reality and where is my mind and where is the truth? But, you know, I'm by myself. No one wants to talk to me. So with the elixir of life, with the DMT, DIPT mix, for the first time, I said, you know, I got to tell somebody about this. I went to my boss and I said, you know, I think everybody knows what's going on, but I want you to know that I think I've discovered something here that we really need to talk about. He said, no, we're not interested. I said, okay. So anyway, I just kept doing my thing, and then some weird stuff happened, and I think finally it just got to be too much, and some of my professors...
What kind of weird stuff happened?
So DMT is known as a trickster. It can be a trickster. Now, okay, it could be obvious by now that I'm taking these compounds and I'm not like doing them in my room or doing them in the forest. I'm doing them at work. I'm doing them in my normal routine, just doing everything the same way I always was. So I'm internalizing it. I'm experiencing it within. And I'm keeping a check on myself. You know, it's like I also began at this point, I realized I was lucid dreaming. You know, in lucid dreaming, you have control over the dream. And I get these ideas that, you know, things have changed, or I can do other things, and I'm like, nah, you know, I keep a hold on that. But what I'm saying about weird things was, I think I began to have lapses of memory in which things happened that I did not realize had happened, because at some point, you know, right there at the end, when this got to be obvious, my professor called me in. He said, do you realize what you were doing the other day? I said, no. He said, you were sitting in the hallway wailing like a banshee. And I don't even remember that. So, you know, that's when I realized that it was really time to stop the DMT and just, you know, go back to the mild stuff. But it was too late at that point. And there were a couple other things that happened that I don't want to talk about, you know, like on this kind of setting. But if I write a book and I get into it, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, I could tell in the right situation, but I need to develop it. I can't just, you know, go and...
I'm going to pause momentarily for an ad. This podcast is brought to you by Matcha Kari, matcha.com.
This is Andrew Weil's Matcha Tea Company. Andrew Weil is one of the pioneers of the study of psychedelic drugs, and he now owns a matcha tea company that sells imported matcha that's tested for heavy metals. If you go to matcha.com, you can see the analysis of all of their teas. I drink it almost every day. It is delicious matcha. If you go to matcha.com and use the discount code Hamilton, you get 10% off any teas that you buy. Thank you, matcha.com.
And do you think that this was from frequent use of DMT, or do you think that the combination of DIPT and DMT was a special contributor?
Well, I think the DMT is the trigger, okay, by itself. But it could be, you know, at that point, I quit doing DMT by itself, because DMT by itself is 15 minutes, and it's just, it blows your mind. It's utterly profound. Well, it can be. I mean, you know, I could take it and just be in a normal setting and nobody realizes what's going on, or at least it seems that way to me. However, yeah, it's so profound that you can lose touch with reality. And, you know, of course, most people take it, these things, in the first place looking to lose touch with reality. They want to see aliens and this sort of thing. But for me, that's easy to do. If you want to see aliens, you see aliens. But I was just looking for what was really there, you know, besides what I could do with it, but what was actually there by itself. And I didn't have any problems, although there were some very interesting experiences. And you know, I have to describe the whole experience for it to make any sense. It's just going to be hard to describe the whole thing. But yeah, I had a lot of very memorable experiences that are, you know, I'm perfectly okay with describing. Some of them are a little more, you know, like, I need to be discreet, but there wasn't really anything that much that I would be embarrassed to tell. I don't want to, you know, just try to describe something that can be misunderstood.
And tell me more about DIPT. How does DIPT differ from other tryptamines that you've tried?
Okay, so anyway, yeah, like DMT is 15 minutes. But now, and they're all different. I also made IT-290. IT-290 is also known as the Cadillac of psychedelics. It lasts for 24 to 26 hours. Very profound. And I was very frustrated with my IT-290 because I could only get it to come out as black crystals. So, but anyway, DIPT had I read about it in the book. Yeah, it had this one very strange effect in that it made women sound like men. And I thought, oh, that's okay. I'm thinking, I got to see this. So anyway, so I make the diisopropyl tryptamine, and I take it, and I'm in the lab, and I realize that the music sounds very weird. It's not music anymore. It's noise. So I had a big stereo in the lab, and when nobody was there, I would turn it up real loud because I'm deaf. But so anyway, I turned the music off, and then I called or received a call from a female lab mate. And she said, "Hello, Mark, this is Holly." And I'm like, "What?" You know, it sounds just like a man, but I know it's a woman. And it was interesting to me because I noticed that it didn't do it to all of the women, but some of the women, their voice, and you know, I'm the one experiencing this, but I haven't let them know, "Hey, you sound weird." But I'm just taking note, internal note of it, that it had this strange effect on sound. That seemed to be the only, you know, they all had this effect, almost all of them, of just a profound sense of peace. But then when you have some other manifold of activity, such as this weird effect that it had on sound, that was very noticeable. So I think diisopropyl tryptamine is a very interesting molecule in itself, and it needs more research, and I'm sure there's a lot of things that will come out of research that were unanticipated. But, I met DMT with all the different ones, but it was just when I met with DIPT that all of a sudden, first of all, the DMT doesn't last for 15 minutes, it lasts for 4 hours because the DIPT does. And in my opinion, I've never done a highball, you know, heroin and cocaine. I hate those compounds because they're toxic, they're poison. You know, you get high on them, but then you pay the price with the poison. But from what I understand of it, in my opinion, the DIPT, DMT would be like the highball of psychedelics, because the DMT would come in and out, you know, the real profound DMT experience, and then it would sort of go out. But again, you know, what we're dealing with here is resonances. They have different frequencies. It's sort of like looking at a mirror that changes its color or, you know, changes its shape or something. What it's all it's doing is reflecting back to you what's already there. So I think, you know, one of the things that makes my experience unique is who I am and where I came from. And, you know, and so it's not like the drug itself would do the same thing to other people. It won't. So the important aspect of my experience is what I put into it, which is who I am, where I came from. And just before I got into the psychedelics, I had gotten into the study of magic. So, you know, that's another big part of the picture. I never really believed that there was such a thing as magic. I never even heard about it until, you know, I'm in the UCLA bookstore one day and I'm just looking for another book to read about something that I don't know anything about, and I come across, and I like biographies. And I discovered Aleister Crowley, and so I bought his hagiography, he called it, and I began reading it. And, you know, I don't take after Aleister Crowley. I think he's a very stupid person who did a lot of crazy stuff. But, you know, his focus was on magic. And then one day I'm at the Bodhi Tree bookstore, and I'm looking at all these books. You know, a lot of people channeling and all this stuff. I'm like, that's too weird. But they had a bookcase there that was locked, and behind the glass with all these books on magic. So I'm like, oh, okay, I just need to figure out what's there. I've never heard of this. So I buy the Golden Dawn System of Magic, and I take it home. And if I may indulge my listeners, I'll tell you about I'll re-describe my experience. So I take home the Golden Dawn System of Magic, and I live at the top of the mountain, 7 houses from the end of the street. At the end of the street is the top of the mountain where I can be by myself and, you know, watch the airplanes come in at L.A. So anyway, I go up there, the sun setting, and I read like a 20-page introduction. And it talked about, well, you know, magic is all about rituals and this sort of thing. And it described one of the oldest of the rituals, which is the banishing ritual of the pentagram. And you know, he described it in such a way that he said, you know, I can't tell you what it'll do. All I can do is say that a lot of people have thought this was magic. I think the ritual was designed by Solomon and his group in order to protect themselves from evil spirits that they brought up to help with the temple. Anyway, I don't know, but the suggestion was that I should just do the ritual and see what happens. So I'm like, you know, and so this is kind of the same mindset that Albert Hofmann had when he went back into the laboratory and resynthesized the 25th analog of lysergic acid, because he just had this feeling that there should have been some activity from the diethylamide derivative. And so he purposely went with the intention of microdosing himself, or taking a very small dose to see if he could feel something. He's basically looking for something that could be used in delivery, you know, in the medical field to cause specific muscles to contract, that sort of thing. And so he didn't really know what he was looking for, but he kind of had a brief idea. So anyway, my dabbling in the ritual was kind of the same thing as what he was doing when he went back in the laboratory. He didn't know exactly what he was looking for, but he decided to find out. So anyway, I go up on top of the mountain. I take the book back and put it in my room. And just to make it like a magic ritual, I don't have a sword, but I take my knife, and I go up on the top of the mountain, and I perform the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram. There's a lot of people, I'm sure there's some listeners out there that are into this sort of stuff. I'm not into Satanism at all. I'm not into magic. But at this point, I just was playing around. I wanted to see. So I performed the ritual. It was in the twilight time of day. It got dark immediately afterwards. So I go back home. I walk back down to the house. Living in a nice big house with a swimming pool. And I go in my bedroom, and I'm tired, so I go to sleep. As I'm going to sleep, I'm thinking, you know, this magic thing, there are a lot of people that are born into it, they're raised into it, they're introduced to it by people that are already in it. I'm going to read about it. So this is going to be how I learn about magic, just by reading about it. Okay, it's like 8:30, I go to sleep. 4 o'clock in the morning, I hear stuff rattling, and I wake up, and I realize what's going on, because I've already experienced a couple of earthquakes in California. So it's like 4:30 in the morning, the Northridge earthquake, which is just on the other side of the mountain. So I wake up and I'm like, it's an earthquake. And I run out the door and I'm standing by the pool watching the lights explode down in the city. The transformers explode and the lights go out and the water in the pool is blasting out 2 feet on the left side, 2 feet on the right side, has the whole mountain rock. And I'm standing there like, wow, what an initiation. So, you know, that was my initiation into magic. I caused an earthquake with the Lesser Banish and Ritual of the Pentagram, which is, as I found out later, because of the way that I drew the pentagram, it is the Earth Banishing Ritual, and then I have an earthquake. So, you know, the coincidences pile up, and you wonder, what is the significance? Is it really just a coincidence, or did that cause an earthquake, you know? You see where I'm going with this? So anyway, this was before I started taking psychedelics, so that's where my mindset was. You know, and I've already described how I had already decided that what I was doing wasn't wrong. I was exploring my own mind, and nobody had the right to say, well, you can't do this, you know. Even though what they were doing it, they were saying, you know, you can't make or take drugs other than what the doctor says you can. But I was doing it, you know. You see what I'm saying? So it's just your mindset. And all the psychedelic does is reflect that back to you. And life in itself, even without the psychedelics, is magic and it's psychedelic. We just sometimes need the mirror to put in front of us, you know, which is the consumption of the compound that creates the resonance. I'm babbling.
No, I think this is great. I think this is wonderful. And for the DMT, how were you administering it?
Okay. The first time that I made it, let me tell you, I made the freebase. And I went home, and I put some in a pipe, and I smoked it. And I'm sitting there waiting for the effect. And nothing happened, but I'm looking at a picture of a castle in the clouds, some famous castle. And I'm looking at it, and the castle flips upside down, right side up, upside down, right side up, at a particular resonance. And I'm sitting there looking at it, saying, why is it doing that? But nothing else happened. And then I walked outside, and I realized that the colors were much brighter, and anyway, all these things. And so I'm like, this is a very interesting drug. However, in wanting to experience it in its purest form, I did not want to experience at the same time my body developing an immune reaction to the heat shock proteins that are the result of, you know, heat entering the lungs, just smoking it. So I said, you know, I would rather make the hydrochloride salt, and I don't mean to be leading anybody into a bad thing, and I don't want them to take this in the wrong way, but I'm a chemist doing, you know, very clean laboratory work, and I made very pure crystals, and I began injecting them into my hip, intramuscularly. I took many intramuscular shots over 3 months. I was sometimes taking it 2-3 times a day. There were a couple of times I stayed up all night, so I took it 5 times in a day. You know, and I was putting it in my hip and trying different muscles, and I found out that the place that really had the most effect was my inner thigh. And it was just amazing. It was like an IV shot. It was instantaneous to take a shot of DMT or the elixir, the mixture of the DIPT. So anyway, that's how I was taking it, and it was just, I can't describe it. I'm going to try to write my book. So anyway.
Do you remember the doses that you were using?
I do not. They were meant to just be, you know, like I said, I've never been into heroic doses, that sort of thing. A lot of people, they want to do things in a very large dose. I was looking for borderline effects. I was just looking for the nature of the compound rather than blowing my mind. So I'm guessing, I can't remember, but I think somewhere around 100 milligrams is a dose. Whatever the standard dose is. Now, however, I was taking basically a standard dose, but there's another story that I want to tell. One of the most profound experiences that I, as far as how I experienced it, was one night when I said, you know, because of these compounds, one of the things that I'm doing is I'm working through all of my fears. I was getting rid of fears. You know, fear is in the mind, and you can kind of rewrite things to do away with fear, that sort of thing. And like I said, I had no fear of getting caught or that I was doing something wrong. But at some point, I realized I didn't have any fear left. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. I do have one fear, and that is the fear of taking too much of the drug. And so I just said, okay, well, I've got to do something about that. And I made up a dose that was probably five times the normal dose. And I didn't want to do it on campus because I had no idea what to expect. So this was a Tuesday, and I had made the DMT, and I had smoked it one time. I just described that. So now I'm going to take a shot. So I made the hydrochloride shot, and it was a Tuesday. And, you know, at this point, I wasn't really anxious to take it. I was just sort of planning things. And anyway, this is a day in which I felt like I had food poisoning. I spent all day in the botanical garden instead of in the lab. And I just felt really lousy, and I've been reading that DMT is the cure for anything. So I'm like, well, that's something I got to find out. So the group meeting was at 7:30, and it was about 4:30 or 5 o'clock that I decided to go take a shower. But before taking my shower, I decided to take a shot, and, you know, because it only lasts 15 minutes, and I was just going to sit there and sit it out and see what happened. But to make this one more interesting, I had, from that study that I've already told you about, I had the blood samples, but I also had a sample of the tea, and I also had a sample of the extract of the monoamine oxidase inhibitor, the Benisteriopsis caapi, the vine. So I had an extract of that, you know, just a real gummy something in a bottle. And so I dissolved that into a syringe, and I added my DMT, so it's sort of like taking a shot of ayahuasca. That's the only time I ever had the inhibitor with my DMT, because that was the only sample I had, and I didn't ever, you know, I could have bought the Homaline and other things, but I never did. Anyway, so that on that night, it's about 5 o'clock, I walked over to the oldest part of campus, which is where the administration building, the library building, you know, it's a big plaza there, and you can sit there at the top of the steps, and there was nobody there, and there's two huge trees, and so I'm going to take a shot. So I sit down, I make a small hole in my pants leg, I stick the needle in, you know, put it right into my upper thigh, and get up and walk over and throw the syringe away, and go back and sit down. And as soon as I sat down, I said, wow, I'm feeling good. And I lay back, and the last thing I remember was seeing the limbs and the leaves of the tree. I could do this visually, but it's hard to describe it. It's just like, you know, there's that three-dimensional image, but now all of a sudden that three-dimensional image became an infinite number of three-dimensional images. It's like all of a sudden I realized I'm just in one dimension. It's actually an infinite number operating simultaneously. I just remember seeing that and thinking, that was it. I don't remember. The next thing I remember was waking up with my eyes closed, and it's just this intense dark blue hum. If you've ever seen the movie Another Earth, I think that the sound that they put in the movie right after the collision, right at the beginning, I think that's the same sound. It's like the sound of DMT, basically. And I wake up to that, and I hear that, and I'm feeling so intensely ecstatic. And I hear what seems to be the problem. And I open my eyes, and I'm sitting in the lotus position at the bottom of the hill, probably, I don't know, 50 yards away. Open my eyes, and there's two policemen, and I'm trying to figure out, oh, boy, where am I? You know, I'm trying to, you know, because I've gotten high many times, but this is when all of a sudden I realized I don't know what I've done. And I'm looking at the police officer, and he asked me again, what seemed to be the problem? And I look over here, and there's three students, and they're sort of like looking terrified. I'm like trying to figure out, what have I done? And I said, problem? I don't see a problem. I'm just sitting here minding my own business. And he says, get up. And I get up, and he says, have you been drinking? I said, no, I don't drink. He said, well, you're doing something. What have you been doing? I said, well, actually, I'm a chemist, and there's just stuff that I've been working with in the lab, and I took some of it. I didn't know what would happen. And I said, what just happened? I don't know. Can you tell me? Would you mind? He said, all I know is you were rolling around. These people called, and they said you were rolling around and banging your head and making all these weird noises. I'm like, okay, you know, maybe it'll come to me, but I don't remember anything. And I'm trying to get more information out of him. He won't give it to me. And he said, so what were you taking? I said, dimethyltryptamine. He said, what? He's trying to write it down. He said, can you spell that? I said, yeah, D-I-M-E-T-I. You know, I could spell it so easily then. Now I have more trouble spelling it, but my mind was so clear. I'm like realizing, you know, there's nothing wrong with what I've done. This is something that other people just don't have any knowledge about, but it's a good thing. So anyway, he interrogates me a little bit more. He said, do you mind going to the hospital to be evaluated? I said, no, not a problem. So he put the handcuffs on me. We walk into the car, and I'm feeling so ecstatic, you know. I don't have the least worry in the world. And I said, this is fun, isn't it? He said, no, not really. So he takes me to the hospital, and I walk in thinking, man, my whole world has changed from now on. And, you know, I'm looking at all the walls. It's just so totally sterile, so white. I'm like, you know, this is what's wrong with the world. It's empty. And then in comes this doctor. And I told him, you know, I said, I'm working with dimethyltryptamine, and I was curious what it did. So I did some. And I said, have you ever done it? He said, no, I've heard about it. It's what they call a businessman's high. You know, it's for rich people because, you know, it's just 15 minutes and they're right back to where they was. So anyway, he knew about it, and he was kind of interested, and then he asked me who the president was, what day of the week it was, you know, general questions like this. I passed the test with flying colors, of course, so he said, well, okay, you can go. I'm walking out the door, and he hollers at me. He said, hey, tell me again, what was your name? And I realized he hadn't even asked me that. That was the first time. I said, Michael. And I was so happy. I went out the door, and I went and took my shower, and then I went to the lab meeting. I was there on time. He's had the most mind-blowing experience of my life, and nobody knew about it. I wasn't going to tell him about it, you know, because I didn't think they would understand. So anyway, that's kind of where it began. And
wow, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like I said, it's the set and the setting. It's what I brought to it. It's not like it's going to happen to everybody. Everybody's going to have their own profound experience, but I'm just telling them, you know, that if you're going to go this way, you need to try to be prepared for what might happen. I think the best way to prepare for DMT is, like I said, is to build up to it by taking the mild psychedelics for a long period of time. And then when you do it, it can be an integratable experience rather than a mind-blowing, can't-make-sense-of-it type of experience. So I'm still trying to figure out what happened that day on the hill. You know, at first I was like, oh, but did I try to fly or something, you know? Because, you know, I have no idea what I did. You know, I wish it was totally illegal and people could go and say, you know, I want some 2CB, I want some DET. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not going to hurt anybody. All it's going to do is make people happier and healthier. But we have a government that's in denial and playing all these weird, stupid games. 2CB is the one that I would recommend for somebody just wanting to get started. If you need a profound religious experience, I would recommend dimethyltryptamine. Or methylene, I think they're very similar. Methylene's about 8 hours, dimethyltryptamine's about 4 hours. You know, they all have a different dose ranges. You have to take a lot of methylene, a small amount of DET, you know, to get a baseline effect. But DIPT is something that, you know, it might be kind of weird if it's like your first psychedelic experience and you just, you know, I don't know. You know, I can only tell you what my experience was, and it's going to be different. I've never met a person who said, you know, I did these things, and I wish I had not. Everybody that's had an experience, I meet people every day, you know, they said, well, I did some back in the day, I did some a long time ago. All the experiences were always positive, so, you know, that's the thing that I would like to see open up is for people to begin, because we live in a very troubled world with so many problems, and all of the problems, okay, and that's a basic reality. And so, if you know, we have this world the way it is because we dreamed it this way, and now we're stuck in kind of something that's becoming a nightmare, and we need to find our way out of it. And the best way, actually the only way out of it, since everything is actually spiritual at its base, we have to dream our way out of it. We have to dream of a different future, you know, because this one's becoming toxic. And the best way to begin to open the mind to dream of another reality is to take these non-toxic, non-addictive compounds, whether they're synthetic or whether they come from nature. I don't see a difference. they're all beneficial, in my opinion. I would recommend it not that they legalize them so that they can control them and tax them. They just need to say, you know, this is off limits. The government has no right to say anything about it. I'm a chemist. I'm a very good-minded person. I'm only interested in people's health. I don't take advantage of people. I'm not interested in making money. All I want to do is good things. And yet, I cannot open a laboratory and make these compounds and do research with them because it's their business, and they've taken that away from us. So I would just like to see the people take this right back to themselves, that it's none of the government's business. The way I describe it, when I was in high school, I was selling pot and selling LSD. I told people, you know what? It is none of their business what I make, take, buy, sell, and possess, especially what I put in my body. That's my own business. You know, if it's something poisonous like cocaine, yeah, okay, I can see them making that illegal, or alcohol should be illegal. Nicotine, you know, these are all poisonous, toxic compounds, but these psychedelics, you know, they're actually, if you start taking them and doing them in the way that I did, you realize it's like, you know, this is food for the brain. We feed our bodies, we feed our muscles, but we don't feed our brains. We poison our brains by watching television, you know. You know, I take all these long walks on the beach, and here in South Carolina, Mount Pleasant, Isle of Palms, Sullivan's Island, I'm walking along the beach, all these big, beautiful, fabulous houses, gorgeous weather outside. I'm the only person on the beach. This is heaven, and I'm the only person out there. It's like all these people, and they're in their houses. Their lives are tied up in their houses. And I think of it as like the electricity is being a prison that's keeping them prisoner. You know, they need to get off of that frequency, that wavelength, and begin to open their minds. And so anyway, that's what I would like to encourage.
And so you mentioned that you were using the DMT pretty frequently, and it's a trickster, and you were starting to behave erratically and not remember all of your behavior. So tell me about what happened at the end. What was...
You want the final straw to break the camel's back? Is that what you want? I can't give you that, but okay. I would tell you this. There was one thing that happened that when they
tell me the whole story. I'm curious. I haven't heard it. I want to know what happened, because you know, other people might listen to this who could learn from your experience. So let me know. Tell me the whole progression at the end.
It's not out there. I haven't told the story, but I will give you the build up to it. And that is that I did something really weird. And the next day, my boss would call me and they said, "Do you know what you did?" I said, "I do. I know what I did, but I have no idea why I did it." And so that was the confusing thing to me. I had no idea. And I'm still prejudiced to the exact mechanism by which actually happened. I can remember how it happened. However, but there was a lot that built up to it. I think they were getting nervous for a long time, you know, for a lot of reasons. And because I was drawing attention to myself and to the university, and it was unwanted attention, I think. And it could just be that I was a bit ahead of my time. But on that particular thing that happened, I didn't see it coming. I did not understand it. And when it did happen, I felt like I was in a dream. And the next day when I woke up, I'm like, did I dream that or did that really happen? Because that's really weird. And it turns out that, no, I really did something really unexpected that was, you know, outside of acceptable behavior. So they said,
what did you do?
No, I'm not going to tell you that. So
you have to tell me. No, this is crucial for the story.
You have to read the book. So
I will read the book, but I will recommend many other people read the book. But you have to tell me; it's crucial for the story.
No, I can't do that.
Well, can you give me an idea?
No, I mean, I'm sure you can imagine. Most people can imagine. Okay, so what could he possibly have done? There's not a whole lot. I mean, I didn't do anything, really totally out of line. I just did something that was totally unexpected.
Did it involve another person?
Yeah, there was another person that I did not even know. So, yeah, it's sort of like something took possession of me. You know, that's the way I would describe it. Because
did you touch another person or what happened?
No, I didn't touch another person, but I just did something that was rather strange. That's all I say. So I hope you change the conversation. I don't really want to go any further than that. And that. But anyway, they called me in and they said, we're going to have to let you go. And so anyway, the adventure continued after that, but it continued without, actually, it was April the 1st when they threw me out. And I had begun taking psychedelics every day for a year, and Friday, May the 13th. So I had just enough to continue my experiment, you know, even after I thrown out, to stay under the influence to May the 13th again. And, you know, it's like when you study shamanism, which is a part of it, and you study alchemy, which is what I began to do, that's all tied in on it. And the vision of the shaman is you climb to the top of the world tree, and then he comes back down to the community to share what he found. And I felt like that I had climbed up to the top of the world tree and I'd become an eagle. I'm sitting up here at the top and I can see all these things from the top of the ivory tower. And I felt like, you know, because of the way it happened, that I tried to fly thinking I was an eagle, but I was a monkey. And so I could, you know, fell to earth. And so they threw me out. And I went to, I had never foreseen this coming, but I'm in L.A., and I had an adventure that began with living on the street as a homeless person, and I got picked up by some people who grew up in and were active in Hollywood. So I went and had a lot of adventures and learned a lot of other things, but I was not allowed to practice chemistry. So I didn't regret it. I didn't resent it. I just felt like, you know, that's just the way the story goes. And, you know, since I had done all the psychedelics and did all that stuff, I was delirious for 2 years laughing. And I realized that I would never, ever be depressed. And I haven't. That's been over 25 years, and I don't think I've ever really, you know, sometimes I have a feeling that there's something negative, but the ecstasy has continued because, like I said, it's just a resonance. You build up the resonance by taking these compounds, and, you know, DMT is sort of, it's at the end of the road. That's going to take you further than you want to go. And you realize, when you think about it, that when you're born, the brain is flooded with DMT. When you die, the brain is flooded with it. In a traumatic situation, it's flooded with it. And that's why strange things happen, because you leave this material world and you go to the spirit world. And as a mathematician, you know, you have these mathematical equations that describe waveforms. But you do a Fourier transform on the mathematical equation, and you get the actual wave. So the equation has all of the frequencies, but the wave doesn't look like it has any of them. So we don't understand all of the resonances that make it up, and there are a lot of them that can be removed, that can be modified. And the psychedelics are the mirror that reflect it back to us, and to sort of do the Fourier transform, and we see what's there, we see the noise. And so as far as what
have you done any chemistry since you were kicked out of UCLA?
No. I used to think that it's possible that somebody would kidnap me, because I'm a very good chemist. And at one point, okay, so this is another part of the story. I guess it's been 5 years after I turned out of UCLA that I was approached by someone. It was a very complicated setup, but they wanted to know if I wanted to make crystal meth. And I'm like, I don't know anything about crystal meth. But no, I don't want to do anything that's illegal. I don't trust anybody, and I'm not going to do something that's illegal. If you make it legal, or if you take me somewhere where it's legal, yeah, I make it. But I'm not going to break the law and risk going to jail or going to prison for it, because, you know, I'm totally against the whole prison thing. And so, no, I haven't dabbled in it any whatsoever. And I had done so much of it that the residences were permanent. I didn't really need any more. So I just went on, you know, like I went back to the community, went just back to just being a normal person. But my life has, you know, developed along an unusual pathway, in that I've basically been homeless ever since then. That's been 25 years now. And, you know, most people hear that word and they think, that's something I don't want to do, I don't want to know about, I don't want to experience. But they have no idea what they're missing. You know, there are a lot of people that are suffering at home. That's a bad thing. And we're all ignoring them. However, I've always had a job. I've always had money. I've always been able to eat wherever I wanted to. But I'm outdoors all the time. I don't really have a permanent place where I can go. I don't have that kind of security. And so I've been living in a different world ever since then. I trespassed, and then I found myself outside the house, basically. It's not a bad thing. It's actually been a very interesting experience. And I've continued in my enthusiasm of contributing, of doing good things. And I've never had such a desire for the drug that I would go and try to make them. Whenever I encountered an offer, you know, it's like it was sent to me. Sometimes I would just go sit somewhere and somebody would come up, you know, it's like a bird, and another bird flies up and says, hey, you know, I've got some LSD, would you like some? Oh, yeah, sure, of course. I don't know who the person is. They fly off. I've got my, you know, I've had a lot of experience like that, especially in California. You go to San Francisco, you go to Santa Cruz, there's a lot of, you know, the LSD still there. And, you know, I'm discovering on Facebook, it seems like there are a lot of people discovering this stuff. I've never tried to make DMT. I've never tried to extract it. As far as I'm concerned, I've had all the experiences that I need to have with it. It's not like I have a craving to do more. But I do like LSD. If I come across a large amount of it and I can afford it, I buy it. And I take, you know, a dose every day. Nobody knows I'm doing it. It's just a resonance that I get on, and it's a very nice, peaceful one. And I've got the resonance with or without it, so it really doesn't make any difference.
How did you get involved in science?
Well, my father couldn't read. He was illiterate. He got run over when he was 6 years old, and he almost died. And it took him 6 months to... He got run over. The man that ran over him got out of the car, the Model T, picked him up, this was in 1927, picked him up, put his eyeballs back in his head, and they thought he would die. Eventually, you know, he recovered. They had to keep him in the house where they cured the meat because there was always a fire there. But when he recovered, he grew up in a pool hall. My dad was just the most lovable dad that anybody could have, I thought. In my mind, he's the greatest man who ever lived. But he had no knowledge about anything like that. He just had a lot of common sense. So the joke was that he had all the common sense and I had all the book sense. I've been a bookworm all my life because I'm profoundly deaf. When I was at UCLA, I didn't have any friends. I didn't socialize. I lived in the lab in the library. You know, if I needed entertainment, I'd go down to Hollywood. Hollywood on Saturday night can be a very strange, interesting place. And I used to do that a lot. During the day, I would get on my bicycle and ride through Bel Air, Beverly Hills. I'd go down to Rodeo Drive, and, you know, and then go back. That's just my lunchtime thing. So, you know, that experience of being exposed to so much just made me hungry for more. And so the best thing about being homeless is that you're outdoors, and I've lived all over the country from Charleston, South Carolina to Santa Cruz, everywhere in between. I've had jobs in almost every state. I build transmissions. It's very easy to find a job.
And you mentioned earlier that the university felt that you were attracting unwanted attention. And not knowing, you know, what you look like, were you a hippie? Did you, you know, wear tie-dye shirts? What kind of attention were you drawing?
Well, I can describe to you my clothes. I've always worn blue jeans. At that time, I was having my shirts laundered. I had, you know, that was really weird. I don't think anybody but me did that. But I liked having cotton shirts that were pressed. And most of the time, I had a vest. I had a nice vest that I wore. And I'm bald. I have problems with my scalp. So I cover my scalp by tying a t-shirt around my head. And I imagine that I probably looked like a pirate, and in my opinion, I was probably a descendant of the most famous of the pirates, Bartholomew Roberts. My last name is Roberts. So, you know, I felt like I'm a lovable pirate. You know, I'm out there riding the high seas, doing the things that other people wish they could do, and they can. They just got to allow themselves. They got to. So anyway, you asked me about my parents. When I wrote about them, I described them as two people that taught me the most important thing in life, and that is freedom. You know, and back in those days in the school, we learned about the Constitution and the history of America in such a way that it was all about freedom. But now I'm beginning to see that there's a lot of stuff going on that, you know, are working against our freedom, and it's something we've got to work towards getting back for ourselves. We're slaves and we don't even realize it. But yeah, my father owned a transmission shop right here on King Street in Charleston when I was growing up, and so that's where I learned how to work on cars. That's always been, well, for the last 20 years, that's how I made my living.
As you know, there's a tremendous resurgence in interest in psychedelics. And there's a new generation of chemists and pharmacologists and psychologists who are not only researching these things, but researching them in a more permissive environment where there is government funding, there is funding from pharmaceutical companies. And I think it's important whenever possible for people to try to learn from the mistakes of the past. And,
yeah.
And almost everything that you've told me, I agree with. I agree that psychedelics are medicines. I agree that using them, even using them very frequently, can have a tremendously beneficial effect. I'm also a chemist. I also use psychedelics frequently. I also believe that using them has had a positive effect. But what happened to you on some level strikes me as a little bit tragic. Clearly you have a good attitude and you've made the best of it, but do you think there's any lesson to be learned for other people listening to this about how best to go about this research from the perspective of self-preservation?
That's a very good question. I wish I had more time to think about it, but right off the bat, you know, I think, of course, the best thing, and I've always gone with the idea of not trying to antagonize the opposition. There is opposition in the government and in tradition that need to be overcome, but it has to be done so in a, you know, in a thought out process. But the first thing is you have to point the will in that direction. In other words, you say, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to happen. And, you know, and the people that are trying to stop it, that are making it difficult, they will eventually wear down. It's like the water against the rock. The water eventually wears it away. It's just a matter of being determined and, you know, going after the opposition rather than just accepting it and going and saying, you know, I think you're wrong, and trying to convince the government, trying not to cause trouble, but just trying to open the door to a meaningful discussion, you know. And so it's important to have evidence to point to, and I am evident. I have done what I've done to prove that there's no harm that can be gotten from even such a blatant approach. So, okay, if you need a word for it, you know, we have these words, medicinal, recreational. Why do you do psychedelics? Well, I do them intentionally. So I am an intentional user. That means it is my intention to use them. I'm not just like, no, I've decided that I want to use them. So it's intentional. Also, there is a purpose. I have an intention to achieve this goal, to achieve this purpose. So, for example, you know, I would take it during the week, doing work, to keep me in a happy, sane, articulate place. But then on Friday, when I get off work, I take it even before I get on my bicycle. And by the time I get home, I'm tripping, if you want to call it that. But so, okay, so right from the beginning, and when I took a dose of DMT and I get home and I'm like, I need to direct my trip. Where am I going with this one? And so I lay down, I close my eyes, and I say, my name is Michael, first of all. And before I went to university, one of the things that I spent a lot of time researching was my name, Michael. What does Michael mean? You know, and it's after I got to university and started experimenting with psychedelics, I began to understand the significance of my other name, which is William, which is about the will. And the will is the importance of the will. It comes out. But anyway, so I take the DOM and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, what do I want to think about? And, of course, with Michael, there comes the enemy, which is Lucifer, Satan, you know, the serpent. So I said, I want to visualize the serpent. And so I close my eyes, and it's in the dark room, and I see the serpent. But I did not anticipate the eagle that flew down and snatched it up in its claws and flew up in the air and pecked its eyeballs out. And I was like, wow, that was a totally unanticipated vision, but I was searching for something. So, you have to sort of decide to go somewhere and be prepared to discover something. And the interesting thing was, you know, at that point, I didn't really think much about the ego. But the next day, I'm like, I need to know more about it. And in the book that I'm reading, it's a book about magic or something. I don't remember what it is, but I turn the page, and the very next chapter is about the ego. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, it's just sort of like I'm interacting with the spirit realm, and it's interacting with me. And it's the sort of thing that you begin to take notice after a while, that the coincidences are too many to be meaningless. There's something going on. And so if you decide to pursue psychedelic consumption for self-awareness, you know, make sure that's why you're doing it. It's not for having fun. I want to use the drug to intensify my experience in the direction that I want it to be. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people that, as I understand it, they get introduced to DMT and these other things through the realm, through this developing thing of Satanism, these people that want to get off on the dark energy and the dark power. And it's unfortunate because they, in my opinion, they end up going down these very intense and very involved energetic pathways that leave them with something that I think is undesirable, you know. When you think about all of these things, when you also think about the whole paradigm, not the psychedelics, but just the whole paradigm of reality, when you come down to it, you know, the resonances, what is the ultimate baseline resonance? It's love. You know, love is the most powerful thing in the world. You cannot control it. You cannot own it. You can only give it away. But it's there. And, you know, when you go into all these dark energies, you're not going to really, you know, get that much in the direction of love. You get in the direction of selfishness and all these things that go with, you know, control and all that. I think if you set your grail, your holy grail, the thing that you're searching for, if you set it for straight up, you know, to the light in the sky, to the stars, you're searching for ultimate awareness of that which is love, then it can't help but benefit. So in other words, you know, that's for setting goals as a consumer. But if you want to set goals as a researcher, you need... This is the whole thing, I think, that really messed it up before. With Timothy Leary and all these people, they tried to guide other people in, you know, we're going to give you a dose and we're going to, you know, try to set the setting and we're going to record it. And that's totally the wrong mindset. People need to just be allowed to do what they want to do and let them come back and tell us what they discovered. So, you know, this is all very deep and complex. For example, you think about magic. Magic is a spiritual thing, and it's the way the world used to operate. Everything operated in all these magical circles of interaction and control and power. But now in the modern world, we have the clock, and we have power, and we have control, and magic is gone. Now everything is down to numbers and clocks and so forth, and the magic has disappeared. And if we let this thing keep going, it will ultimately destroy everything. But if we do away with it and we go back to living in nature and to cultivating nature and to cultivating the magic, that we have to discover the magic that's within us. And that's what these drugs will help us to do, because right now it's suppressed, it's hidden, it's subtle. And we're living in worlds in which our attention is totally dominated with all these ideas about survival. You know, if I don't make money, if I don't pay the bills, totally destroyed the magic in people. So right there, you know, that's an idea of why we need to, we don't need to research it. We just need to open the doors and let people research it. And then, you know, they'll write their own books. And then, you know, if you're a scientist and you can help to summarize everything and to write other books. And, you know, in other words, you can't control a flower. A flower has to just be given food and allowed to blossom. And it's the same thing with the human existence. We have people that are dying because their frequencies, their minds, their resonances have been so totally dominated and controlled by fear and anger and anxiety and all these negative emotions that we have to help them. And the greatest thing we can do to help them is to allow them to take these non-toxic, non-addictive compounds. So, you know, the only research that I want to see is research that I want to do, and that is how to best make these compounds, how to make them. You know, and make lots of them. And then also be able to say, well, you know, I have a lot of experience. This particular person, they might be best off to start with DET or with 2CB or whatever. You know, that's the kind of research that needs to be done to try to help people go in the right direction. But eventually, I hope we have a whole planet of people whose minds have been completely open. And, you know, that'll be a whole new magical thing in which there's no death and disease and all these problems that we have. We don't have to go to the grocery store and buy food. We walk outside and pick it off a tree because we'll be awake to the paradigm of love and of life and of organic regeneration. You know, this whole concept of medicine and science and all, it's gotten out of control.
Well, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so you're like a mirror to me. You know, I have all these thoughts, but I don't know they're there. But by your asking these questions, you're like a mirror to me. You are helping me to see myself. I appreciate that you've done this, and I appreciate that you accept what I've said. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I really look forward to you writing a book, and I hope to continue talking because it sounds like you've got a lot of stories to tell.
Oh, I do. Everybody does. Everybody does, really. I'm just trying to open the door.